Hello, my name is Utah Phillips, the golden voice of the great Southwest, and you're listening to Loafer's Glory, the hobo jungle of the mind.
Says in description of the rats, it says, rats! They flipped the dogs and knocked out the cats and nipped the babies in their cradles and held cheese and cracker parties right in the vats and slooped up the soup from the cook cat's own ladles and split with the kegs of salted sprats and blew jam sessions in the men cat's Sunday hats and even hung up the lady cat's backyard chats by topping their speaking, the shrieking and squeaking off-pitch rat style rhythm and blues that shook all the chicks right down to their shoes. That's some rats, ain't it?
Well, yes, this is Utah Phillips here in my home in Nevada City, California. The voice you just heard was that of his hypnotist, Lord Buckley, during an old interview with Studs Terkel. The little huh you heard right at the end of that was Studs Terkel responding to part of the rendition of the Pied Piper of Hamelin. I'm here with Steve Baker, the engineer. Of course, that was the Borsdorfs. You were just listening to Hawks and Eagles playing the theme, Loafer's Glory. I'm at the studios of KVMR, Community Radio, here in Nevada City, where we have just finished our weekly fundraising appeal. We do drone on and on, like all you community stations out there, and you know it. But, of course, this is especially important before KVMR goes to an all-immigrant radio format. My next show will be in rather fluent Urdu, which I learned while serving with a British thermal unit. Nevada City, of course, is my hometown, locked here in the mountain fastness of the Sierra. We're, of course, in the midst of a county municipal election. I have very little to do with such things. If elections could change this system, they'd be against the law. Idaho Blackie told me that. God, a fellow running for mayor has some rather interesting ideas for Nevada City, for the county, you know. He wants to, well, people during the summer go up to the Yuba River. It's a tradition around here to go swimming in the Yuba, to hang a sign in the door of your store, say, gone to the Yuba, gone swimming. There's a big, beautiful pools around the rocks. Well, Mayor Stewart is going to deal with the emerging homeless problem here in Nevada City by having concrete shopping cart trails built along the Yuba, where the homeless look little off-ramps so that you can go down and bathe and hammer your clothes on the rocks like people used to do a long time ago. I live in a very interesting town, my friends. Well, this is going to be something endemic in my very being, a program of a spoken word, of words spoken out loud. That's why I open this up with Lord Buckley. Storytelling, poetry. I remember working for Earl M. Lyman in a warehouse, Amass M. Lyman's grandson. He's one of the original apostles of the Mormon Church. I was working there in a warehouse in Salt Lake City, Utah, after I got back from Korea. Old man Lyman, he used to hoist himself up on my packing table, lean his back up against a big roll of butcher paper, and tell stories. Well, of course, while he was telling stories, I couldn't work because I couldn't wrap packages. So I would go to the library and read up on Mormon history and come back in with three or four questions that would provoke him into climbing on my bench and telling stories, which, of course, is how I learned the importance of storytelling, especially if you're going to lead a life of sloth and indolence. Earl Lyman. When I went back east in 69 to take up this trade, one of the first people I met at a folk festival was Marshall Dodge. Marshall Dodge was a down east storyteller. That flat, nasal, a kind of storytelling that's so understated. Marshall Dodge is the main storyteller, me as the Western storyteller, and Gamble Rogers as the Southern Gothic storyteller would go to festivals together and do workshops and performances of those various styles. Marshall Dodge was an apostle of the bicycle. Boy, you ought to have seen him. Marshall, I might tell you, abandoned track up there in Maine and in New Hampshire, and Vermont, he would find out where the abandoned track was. He had two bicycles with tube steel between them and fat rims that would fit right on the rails. And you'd see him pedaling mile after mile down these abandoned railroad lines. And sometimes he had a sail he could put up and a little hamper in between the bikes with wine and cheese. And my first time seeing him was cruising down the abandoned track of the Vermont Central Railroad with the sail up, sitting backward on the bicycle seat, eating a sandwich. That's quite a vision, isn't it? Now, I'm not making this up. Marshall Dodge was an apostle of the bicycle. Unfortunately, he was killed in a bicycle accident while performing in Hawaii. But right now, I want you to listen to my old friend, Marshall Dodge, tell you a story from Maine.
Cutler, Cutler Harbor, why, that was where I was born and raised. Lived there all my days, man and boy, following the sea. Well, I say following the sea, I ain't never done much blue water sailing, mostly just coasting. You see, I had me a little jib and mainsail boat, the Nancy and Betsy, and me and me nephew Willie and me, we run it. We didn't carry no hands, we really didn't need no hands, 'cause though the mainsail was heavy for Willie and me, we just eased the peak and let the mainsail flap. Well, now you'd have thought we'd have known every ripple and reef from here to Eastport and back again, but then again I recollect that time we was taking on a deckload of lumber for transporting off to Ram Island. And we got in off Goat Head there when there come a hail from shore. It seems they was having a hair-setting party, what you might call a christening. Well, we put in close up under the head there and dropped anchor. We lowered the jib, but we didn't have to lower the mainsail. The mainsail was kind of heavy for Willie and me, so we just eased the peak and let the mainsail flap. We went ashore there, and when I tell you that they had two barrels of Barbados rum jacked up there on the beach, you'll understand me when I tell you that they were parting the baby's hair good and proper. Well, after a while, we started to part in a few hairs ourselves, and I said, look, Willie, if we're going to get off on this tide, we better get a move on. So we went back aboard the Nancy and Betsy. We weighed anchor. We raised the jib, but we didn't have to raise the mainsail, because, you see, we hadn't lowered the mainsail. The mainsail was kind of heavy for Willie and me, so we had just eased the peak and let the mainsail flap. Well, we raised the peak and set sail out of there and had gone for no more than 5 minutes. When there come in one of them fogs you get around Cutler way, so thick you can't see your nose in front of your face. I said, Willie, where be we? He said, I don't know. Well, I said, Willie, I think you'd better go below decks and bring up that coastwise pilot. Well, he brung it up, and it were kind of a tattered edition, and he no sooner got it open to the Cutler page when there come along a little wind, just a zephyr, and blew that page overboard. I said, what are we going to do now, Willie? He says, I don't know. Well, I think we'd better ponder. So we dropped anchor, we lowered the jib, but we didn't have to lower the mainsail. The mainsail was kind of heavy for Willie and me, so we just eased the peak and let the mainsail flap. And then, oh my Lord God, how we did ponder. First Willie pondered, then I pondered. We took turns of pondering. Then all at once did come to me. Willie, I says, I've got it. I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to weigh anchor, we're going to raise the jib, we're going to raise the peak, we're going to set sail out of here, and we're going to keep a sailing, by God Almighty, until we get over into this next page here, and then we'll know where we be.
Well, that was Marshall Dodge, my old friend Marshall Dodge. I miss him a great deal. He was doing Cutler Harbor. You know, those are for the Burton Eye records. There are about six of them, and I don't know if Yankee Magazine is still being published, but they always were advertised in Yankee Magazine if you want to collect and listen to some real old Down East humorous stories. Spoken word. I love to palaver. I love the argot. I love the lingo. I like all kinds of languages. I've done on other shows, I've played you music where I couldn't understand the words, and that was fine with me. One of the great abominations of the Western world is supertitles and the opera. Reading is one thing, listening to music and watching great theater is another. I don't live in a hyper-literate culture. The world I create for myself is one that's made out of speakers and listeners. I always wondered what it would be like to live in a pre-literate culture, how people thought before reading and writing. And I know they thought a whole lot differently than we do. Just from my exposure to Well, down on the skids, you know, to tramps, to old people on the skids who never went to school and never learned how to read and write. You know what I find? I find that there is an intense preoccupation with the next half hour. It's a very immediate kind of existence. I want to give you a poem I made up here. I used to be, I would go over to SPD, our local supermarket, and get myself one of those Rocky Jr. Chickens. They're range-fed chickens. The range-fed is sweeping the world, you know that. I heard there's a whole tribe of cannibals in Borneo that are running range-fed missionaries. Of course, they can't boil the Catholics because they're friars. Aren't you glad you're not paying for this? Well, anyway, I'd get one of those chickens and I would tattoo my poems on it and then have poultry readings. Now, this actually happened, called The Old Guy Takes a Shower. Toweling down, I noticed that the hair in my right armpit was missing, gone. Mange, Korean fungus, some hypertensive body joke. In any case, another fiscal jolt along the rocky road to my deductible. Let me see, she said, arm up, naked, her touch. Why, it's not gone. Just turned pure white, that's all. A downy, transparent white. Invisible. Oh, I have watched my slowly graying self for 63 years and hardly noticed. Now this. You there, all of you, check each other's armpits now. Age is stalking us here, sniffing out our unsuspecting lives, secreting itself about our persons, striking us dead. Lovely to find it that way, though, toweling down. It's just turned white, she said. Lovely. Well, that's a poem about aging gracefully. My favorite poem of that kind, in fact, one of my favorite poems of all time. And I love to hear poetry intoned. Poetry today comes out of the hand and in at the eye, and it loses its music. One of my favorite poems to hear said, Stanley Kunitz, 78 years old, he recorded King of the River.
If the water were clear enough, if the water were still, but the water is not clear, the water is not still, you would see yourself slipped out of your skin, nosing upstream, slapping, thrashing, tumbling over the rocks till you paint them with your belly's blood. Finned ego, yard of muscle that coils, uncoils. If the knowledge were given you, but it is not given, for the membrane is clouded with self-deceptions, and the iridescent image swims through a mirror that flows, you would surprise yourself in that other flesh, heavy with milt, bruised, battering towards the dam that lips the orgiastic pool. Come, bathe in these waters, increase and die. If the power were granted you to break out of your cells, but the imagination fails and the doors of the senses close on the child within, you would dare to be changed as you are changing now into the shape you dread beyond the merely human. A dry fire eats you. Fat drips from your bones. The flutes of your gills discolor. You have become a ship for parasites. The great clock of your life is slowing down, and the small clocks run wild. For this you were born. You have cried to the wind and heard the wind's reply. I did not choose the way chose me. You have tasted the fire on your tongue till it is swollen black with a prophetic joy. Burn with me. The only music is time. The only dance is love. If the heart were pure enough, but it is not pure, you would admit that nothing compels you anymore. Nothing at all abides but nostalgia and desire, the two-way ladder between heaven and hell. On the threshold of the last mystery, at the brute absolute hour, you have looked into the eyes of your creature self, which are glazed with madness, and you say, he is not broken, but endures, limber and firm in the state of his shining, forever inheriting his salt kingdom, from which he is banished forever.
Stanley Kunitz, the king of the river. Storytelling is a way of life. We're all storytellers. You remember explaining to your mother why you got home late because you sat through that double feature twice. The excuses you made up, like Rosalie Sorrells used to try to tell her mother why the library stayed open till 4 o'clock in the morning. We are all storytellers. It's just that I'm one of those who never gave it up. I think my stepfather, Sid Cohen, who raised us, recognized that when we moved to Utah. For some reason, he had a do bill down at the Flamingo in Las Vegas. And that was, at that time, there was nothing else on the Strip. There was no Strip. There was just the Flamingo. And my father had a 50 Buick Riviera. That thing could go over 100 miles an hour. Of course, in southern Utah, there were no speed limits then. So he used to get me in the car, and past St. George, Utah, headed for Las Vegas. He'd unwind that to over 100 miles an hour. We get to Las Vegas, and the reason I was along with him was because he'd found out that Myron Cohen, the great Jewish storyteller, was performing, and he wanted me to hear Myron Cohen. I couldn't go into the lounge, into the bar there, but I could stand at the door, and I listened. And then I had an opportunity to talk to Myron Cohen backstage. The only question I had at my age, it was hard to come up with the right questions, was said, how do you decide on what stories to tell? How do you decide what stories you're going to tell out there? And he said, well, I listen to bar jokes. I listen to jokes that people tell me that stop me in the hotel. And there, a lot of jokes are jokes that have victims. And he said, I have to change those so there are no victims. If there's one thing that I say to myself about telling stories is that I try to tell stories that don't have any victims. I think that was probably the first great lesson in storytelling that I ever had. Right now I want you to listen to just a little hint of Myron Cohen here, Goldberg the Spy and Matzo Ball Soup.
And I want you to imagine the office of the top man at one of our undercover agencies, talking to one of our undercover agents. This is a soundproof room. Not a word may be heard outside that room. And the top man says to the agent, this is life or death, top secret, highly classified. Only you and I in the world know of this mission. Before I tell you another thing, you must take this poison pellet because you dare not be taken alive. One wrong move and you must take the poison pellet. You dare not be taken alive. You're to go to Yugoslavia. Search out our spy, Goldberg. When you find him, the code message is the sun is shining. He will then give you further instructions, but remember, one false move, you're a dead man. Top secret, highly classified. So he goes all the way to Yugoslavia, searches out the address, 5315 Flickelflaggerstrasse. Was a walk-up. Little bit of a hallway, a bunch of bells and a bunch of names, and lo and behold, there are two Goldbergs. Begins fiddling with the poison pellet. Dodges could be the move. So he does as you and I might have done, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and he pushes the top Goldberg button. The door clicks, he walks to the top, there's a door ajar, and a man standing in the doorway. He says, Goldberg? He says, yes. He says, the sun is shining. He says, oh, you want Goldberg to spies on the second floor. Thank goodness the nation liked it, and I hope you will. It's about a man who, for 20 years of his life, was madly in love with a delicacy called matzo ball soup. He wouldn't go to bed a night of his life until he'd had his matzo ball soup. He walked into his favorite restaurant. The waiter had seen him coming, was prepared for him. The customer no sooner sat down than with a flourish, the waiter placed the matzo ball soup before him, went off into a corner to watch this man relish the delight of his life. Well, here he sat, made no attempt to eat, just sat there looking at the plate like a mummy. After about 5 minutes, the waiter could contain himself no longer. So he walked up to the customer and he says, "What's the matter? You don't feel good? Something bothers you?" No answer. Waiter says, "Maybe it's too hot, I'll blow on it." No reply. Again, the waiter says, "Maybe it's too cold, I'll hotten it." Still not a word. Now in despair, the waiter says, "For God's sake, you got to say to somebody something. What the hell is it?" Customer says, "All right, smart guy, taste it." The waiter leaned over, he says, "Where the hell is the spoon?" He says, "Uh-huh."
That's Myron Cohen. Myron Cohen was a lesson to me just to be able to watch him work. I don't know if Myron is still out on the boards or not, but one of the greats. Colonel Charles Goodnight and Oliver Loving, pioneer settlers of the old Southwest and folk heroes, both of them. Founders of the great Goodnight Loving Trail, the westernmost of the great cattle trails from El Paso, Texas to Denver, Colorado, with a spur into Montana. In years gone by, I have left my home and gone about the country telling stories about Oliver and the Fork and his outhouse, about the great turtle drive of 86. And if you missed that one, well, it was a rare beauty. Here's a story about their middle years. Colonel Goodnight was living in Taos, New Mexico. Of course, Oliver Loving had the remuda, the horses that travel with any herd, so he had corralled them on the outside of town. One day, Colonel Goodnight loped up. His horse was limping. He dismounted, knocked politely on Oliver's door, and said, when Oliver came to the door, "Oliver, as you know, I'm a prominent folk hero hereabouts, and I have some fairly serious folk hero business to get at. When my fool horse stepped in a chuck hole and lamed itself, I'd appreciate it if you'd see your way clear to sell me another horse." "Well, sure," Charlie Oliver said, "I've got a really fine horse here, but you don't want it." "Well, how's that, Oliver?" "Well, Charlie, like I said, it's an altogether fine horse. It's got good wind, it's got good blood, but it's an egg-setting horse." "It's a what?" "It's an egg-setting horse, Charlie." "Why, damn you, Oliver Loving, for 50 years of my life, I have had to listen to your rural ribaldries, your raucous rusticana, your fecal badinage. I'm not about to spend another 50 years listening to it, neither. Now sell me that damn horse, egg-setting indeed." Sold him the horse. Well, Colonel Goodnight loped off down the road in pursuit of folk hero biz. Other side of the fence there by the road was a little nest full of prairie chicken eggs. Well, that horse spied it, flew into the air, sunfished once, cast Colonel Goodnight down into the dust, leapt over that fence and sat down on them eggs. Colonel Goodnight was astonished. He picked himself up, slapped out the dust with his Stetson, clambered down that embankment, jerked, reined that dumb brute back up onto the road, mounted it, saddle-wise, loped off down the road one more time in pursuit of folk hero biz. Now, he was crossing the old Taos River Bridge there before the river changed the course, you know. And that horse leapt into the air one more time, threw Colonel Goodnight down onto the board, fractured his collarbone. That horse leapt off of the bridge and sat down in the water. Well, now, Colonel Goodnight was madder than a boiled owl. He climbed down into that creek, and he jerned right that dumb brute back up onto the road, turned it around so it faced the other direction, clumb up on it, put the steel to it, rode hell-bent for leather back to Oliver Loving's little cabin, where he vaulted from the saddle, ripped the door from its frail leather hinges, drug Oliver Loving out by the hair of his head, said, "Damn you, Oliver Loving. I know you told me that was an egg-setting horse, and I didn't believe you, but it's an egg-setting. You see that yellow runny stuff on its front? Sat right on them eggs. But when I was crossing the old river bridge there, you know, before the river changed its course, that horse threw me into the air. It kept fractured my collarbone, leapt off of the bridge and sat down in the water. And I want to know why." "Oh, Charlie," Oliver said, "I forgot to tell you, sits on fish too." Now, That's the funniest story I ever heard in my life. And if you are not at home rolling on the floor, emitting gales of laughter, well, then damn be to you. Pop Wagner's an old friend of mine. Good cowboy singer, good roper. I mean, he does rope tricks like Will Rogers. He's the only one I know who will douse his rope with that fluid that fire breathers use, set it on fire, and then leap back and forth through it. It must prove to be some aggravation to the cattle, however. Want to hear Pop Wagner? You can listen to him right now. Doing a poem here that goes all the way back to the beginning of cowboy poetry, Pertnere Perkins.
They called him Pertnere Perkins, for unless the bugger lied, he'd Pertnere done most everything that he had ever tried. He'd Pertnere been a preacher, he'd Pertnere roped a bear, and he'd met up with Comanches once and Pertnere lost his hair. He'd Pertnere wed an heiress who had money by the keg. He'd Pertnere had the measles and he'd Pertnere broke his leg. He'd Pertnere been a trail boss once and according to his claim, he'd Pertnere shot Bill Hickok and that had Pertnere made his fame. Pertnere rode some horses upon which no one else had stuck. In fact, he was the feller that had Pertnere drowned the duck. Now, mostly all the boys around the lazy SB spread just took his talking with a grin and let him fight his head, except one named Tom McGinnis who kind of told it to him tough when he said, "You're riding with an outfit now where Pertnere ain't enough. We dally our last ropes to the horn and what we catch we hold, and Pertnere is an alibi we never do unfold. In fact, I'm going to tell you there's no words I ever hear that sounds so dad blame useless as that little pair Pertnere." Well, that's how Tom McGinnis laid it out along the line, like a heap of preaching talking, and it sounded mighty fine. But one day, Tom McGinnis, while riding off alone, lamed his horse and had to catch a neighbor Nestor's roan to get back to the ranch on. But somewhere along the way, a bunch of Nestors held him up, and there was hell to pay. Tom claimed he hadn't stole the horse, had just borrowed it to ride. But those Nestors hated cowboys, and they told him that he lied. They cussed him for a horse thief, and they'd caught him with the goods, so they set right out to hang him in a nearby patch of woods. They had poor Tom surrounded, their guns all fixed to shoot. Looked like this poor cowboy sure had heard his last owl hoot. They tied a rope around his neck and threw it o'er a limb, and Tom McGinnis Pertnere knowed that that was it for him. Then suddenly a shot rang out from somewhere up the hill. The Nestors dropped their rope and ran, as Nestors sometimes will when bullets get to whizzing. And Tom's heart leapt up with hope to see old Pertnere Perkins riding towards him at a lope. "Looks like I Pertnere got here just in time," old Perkins said, "to see them Nestors hang you." Well, Tom's face got kind of red. "You Pertnere did," he Pertnere grinned. "They Pertnere had me strung. You're looking at a cowboy that has Pertnere just been hung. And also one who's changed his mind. For no words ever said can sound as sweet as Pertnere when a man's been Pertnere dead."
Here we are back again after that little Mexican, sprightly Mexican rondelay by Blind Kenny Hall down in the city of Fresno. Let me tell you a story. I was in the East right after I left Utah. I was in New York City. I went all the way back to the Big Core. The apple had long since been eaten. The first place I played there was at a YMCA. It was a matinee show with the great harmonica player Saul Brody. And I remember that occasion particularly because on the marquee out in front of the YMCA, it said Utah Phillips and Dips Daily. And I thought they double-billed me with some old vaudeville hoofer. It turned out the Dips Daily simply meant that you could swim there every day. Well, I was on the stage there, and I said to the audience, now I have 2 hours to be in Manhattan. I've not been here before. Would you take me to see your privileged legend, that which only you who have grown up here would know about? Now, don't take me to the Empire State Building. I've got limited time. Don't take me to the tourist attractions. What characterizes, what summarizes Manhattan more than any other single thing? Well, after the show, a fella came up to me and said, follow me. So I followed him. We got on the subway and went down to Chinatown, went down to the Battery. I always wondered where they got the electricity to run those subways, and then we got to the Battery, and I understood it. There in Chinatown, we were on Mott Street. We walked down a small flight of stairs into a Chinese penny arcade, and there in a big glass cage was a chicken, kind of asleep. And then a sign there explaining how the chicken was raised and how well it was cared for. But if you put a quarter in that machine, a light bulb went on, the chicken woke up, went over to the other side of the cage through a little door, and danced on a wheel while this rinky-dink music played. And then when the music stopped, it went back into and sat down on its perch, and then a food treat rolled down a little trough and into its mouth. And a card popped out of a slot underneath the coin slot that was redeemable at the cash register for a Neolithic fortune cookie. That was the dancing chicken of Mott Street, folks, and it's still there. You know, talk to my doctor. You talk to my doctor. He'll tell you. He went and saw it. I sent him to look at it. Now, I've told that story to people all over the country when I've been in somebody's strange town, big and little. And I wanted to know what the privileged legend was. I'd tell them the story of the dancing chicken. And I say, now, it doesn't have to be funny. It can be tragic. It can be a person. It can be a phrase. It can be a place. But what is it that makes this place special? And I have been taken to see marvels and wonders. I have been taken to see, to worship, the dancing chicken of America. I want to tell you about one of those encountered in Springfield, Illinois. Now, you go to Springfield, the thing people normally look at is Lincoln's birthplace and all the Lincoln-iana, I guess they call it. Well, not me. I got a tip from, let's see, old Harvey Coplow that I ought to go see Elizabeth Campbell. Now, the great poet Vachel Lindsay, do you remember him from school? Boom, belay, boom, belay, boom, belay, boom. The great poet Vachel Lindsay lived in Springfield. He lived in a fine old house across from this Lincoln Museum, across the square. His mistress and former school teacher was Elizabeth Campbell. And I was told that Elizabeth Campbell, since he'd passed away many years before, still kept his house and kept it open for visitors. But she might be cranky. You didn't know whether you're going to be able to get in or not. Well, I went down there, and I banged on her door. And I had figured out how I was going to get in. You see, Vachel Lindsay used to paint as well as make poetry, these really odd paintings. And when I was living in Spokane, Washington, his patron was Louis Davenport, who built the big Davenport Hotel, one of the pleasure palaces of the West. And Vachel Lindsay painted a painting on one of the walls called The City of Laughing Bells. Of course, over the years, it was just painted over many times. When I lived in Spokane, I'd taken on the task of finding that painting. And I did, and it was being restored when I left. Well, I knocked on the door, and an elderly woman, white-haired lady with one strap on her dress off to one side, and she looked out the crack in the door, and I said, hi, my name's Utah Phillips, and I'm from Utah, and I think I've found the City of Laughing Bells at Louis Davenport's hotel up there in Spokane, Washington. Well, she flung the door and said, oh, God, I thought that painting had been lost for years and years. Well, she had me in. She took out Vachel Lindsay's poetry, and it looked like he had just stepped out to get a pack of smokes. You know, his stuff was all still lying around. The house was lived in. She gave me his poetry in his manuscripts. She sat on a chair daintily and had me stand posed by the piano and read his poetry to her. She went up to the attic and found old recordings on aluminum discs that had never been released of Vachel Lindsay reciting his own poetry, which is so completely different from seeing it on the printed page. But she told me that Vachel Lindsay had spent all the money he earned traveling the country doing poetry readings and publishing poetry, spent it all on Springfield, getting the Rose Garden put in. He said, if you can't do it at home, where are you supposed to do it? He caused a big carillon to be built with the bells all up. You could see the bells looking at it from both sides of the tower. And it wasn't electric. It had a little box up at the top. And you took an elevator up there, and there was a guy in there playing the carillon. It was all mechanical linkages. The keyboard, you pound him with your fists. And he had this carillon music laid out in front of him, and he had real thick glasses and wide spaces between his teeth, and this was just the right guy for the job. Now, the first landing on that elevator, you got off at it, was the big bell, the enormous B-flat bell. And as you took the landings going up, the bells got smaller. Well, when I was up there talking to the carillonist, looking at the mechanical linkages, I said, can you play something that uses the big B-flat bell? He said, well, yes, I can. I leafed through the pages there. And I said, well, this will do. I said, give me a minute. So I took the elevator back down to the first landing, and I got out, and I stood right next in the open there, right next to the B-flat bell. Well, he started playing. Up there banging away, and I could see the bells clanging up above me, and finally he hit the final cadenza, ning, bang, 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 all the way down. Then I saw the lever in front of me pull and the tongue over and hit that B-flat bell, and friends, it pushed my cellular structure over about 4 centimeters. I am really not here. I am still 4 centimeters over there. Vachel Lindsay. When you see what I mean, it's a different way of looking at America. It's not exactly Charlie Cure-All, but it'll cure all. I really want you to listen to Vachel Lindsay, just a short piece of his. Hard to understand. It's an old record. It's called The Flower-Fed Buffalo.
The flower-fed buffaloes of the spring, in the days of long ago, ranged where the locomotives sing and the prairie flowers lie low. The tossing, blooming, perfumed grass is swept away by the wheat. Wheels and wheels and wheels spin by in the spring that still is sweet. But the flower-fed buffaloes of the spring left us long ago. They gore no more, they bellow no more, they trundle around the hills no more, with the Blackfeet lying low, with the Pawnees lying low, lying low.
Well, that was Vachel Lindsay. I'm so glad you had a chance to hear that. I remember so well standing in her living room and listening to the old recordings of that. And you know, there was a little tiny note on the wall that she'd pinned up there, and it was a note that Vachel Lindsay used to send out to places he was going to recite. And it's, and the name of it was What I Want from a Town. And there he would describe exactly what I was doing, the Dancing Chicken. He'd say, I want to have a guide for the day that I'm there that's familiar with the architecture, the history, and the politics of the town, and is willing to put up with an enormous number of questions, in exchange for which can request whatever he wants to hear when I do my program that evening. Well, the guy that had the right idea, and I mentioned that to Miss Campbell, and you know, about 6 months later, and I was back in Spokane, the postman rang the bell. Normally he puts the mail in the mailbox. Postman rang the bell, and he handed me a tiny, 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 about like a soda straw, rolled up, a piece of paper, blue paper, tied with a violet thread, and the tiniest, tiniest lettering on it. And that was Elizabeth Campbell sending me that piece by Vachel Lindsay through the mail so that I would be able to use it, and partly as a remembrance. Well, let's go to Chicago now. I was playing at the Earl of Old Town down on Wells Street, an after-hours joint, where he'd always try to squeeze that fourth set out of you for the drunk salesmen who were in town for a convention. That's where you cut your teeth at a job like mine. You know, that's where you learn how to, that's where you really learn how to do it. And I got along fine in that place because I sang labor songs. You may not think that that, well, it is folk music, but I mean, you're talking about, you know, a crowd of pretty heavy drinkers. I found that if I sang labor songs and then reminded people of how hard it was to be a cocktail waitress, that the waitresses would get with me and make those tables be quiet, you understand? And I could raise the tips about 40% doing that, so I always got along okay there. One time, a fellow that shared the bill with me was Gamble Rogers, and he was from I can't pronounce the name. Oh, it was pretty close to St. Augustine, Florida. He was, I guess you'd call a monologist. He did monologues. He did these, like, Southern Gothic monologues with great florid language. I remember, and he was of a great service to me because I was still green in the trade. And Gamble heard me do my show one night. I had breakfast with him the next morning at the restaurant, the hotel where he was staying. And he said, we talked about books, we talked about philology, we talked about etymology, all kinds of things. He said, you know, when you're sitting here talking to me, I hear you use a different language than the one that you use on the stage. You know, it's much more complete. You know, if you try using the language you possess on the stage, you might be able to say what you want to say a whole lot better. And so, yes, my life took a turn. My storytelling took a turn, thanks to Gamble Rogers. Well, let's listen to Gamble do a piece of his. Gamble passed away in a boating accident. He dove into the water there in Florida to try to save somebody who was drowning, and the undertow carried them both away. Gamble Rogers, Saturday afternoon at the Baby Grand.
Is there a man amongst you? Is there a woman amongst you? Who can tell me the meaning of nostalgia? What is it, rumble seats and running boards? Clamshell fenders and bullet headlights? Or is it the movies, Humphrey Bogart, Marlena Dietrich, Howard Duff, and Ida Lupino? Yes, I think somehow nostalgia is couched in the movie. We had two motion picture theaters in Nacoochie Valley. The Colony Theater at the south end of the street where they showed those heavy psychedelic flicks like Fantasia. And at the other end of the street, the Baby Grand Theater. A dank, cavernous mow of a place decorated in Renaissance redneck. Smelled like a Byzantine pissoir. We'd sit in there of a Saturday matinee and scarf up on those jujubes, junior mints, milk duds, Necco wafer, Jordan almonds, sugar babies. Remember those little sugar babies? Damn sticky things. Play a trick on your best buddy, Bogart your sugar baby, and stick it in his ear. And there was always some little idiot in the audience. He would sidle out into the lobby in the middle of the picture with a box of butter popcorn hidden under his shirt, ease up to the water fountain, step on the switch, directing a clandestine crescent of clear water into the popcorn box, turning its contents into a soggy, glutinous, viscous, vegetable mass of oily corruption and putrescence. He would then ease up into the balcony, and at precisely the heaviest part of the flicker, the patrons there below would be startled to hear from out of the Stygian void above the non-sonorous sounds of gastronomical distress. As our young pilgrim leaned far out over the parapet, broadcasting the popcorn in a slimy torrent over their heads and shoulders, all the while going,
Have you ever done that? If there are any kids listening out there, you just got yourself a whale of a good task set for you. My best and oldest friend in the world is Rosalie Sorrell. She is now recovering from breast cancer surgery up there in Grimes Creek in Idaho. And it came on very, very suddenly. I just talked to her on the phone, and she's doing doing really well. And but she has a constitution like iron. It's absolutely unbelievable. Folks all over the country are going to help Rosalie get through this this dreadful thing. But she's this vast elan, great joie de vivre. We're going to do a piece of hers. By the way, I really would like to take this opportunity to thank the Haitian World Fund of the Tides Foundation for making all of this palaver possible. Rosalie's mother, Nancy, well, I knew her. She ran a bookstore in Boise, Idaho for many, many years. She's gone now. But she wrote some wonderful things that were never published until Rosalie finally saw to it that they were. I want you to listen to Rosalie Sorrell's reciting a piece that her mother wrote in a longer work called Letters from Grimes Creek. Rosalie Sorrell's.
Old ladies sitting in the far corner of the room when company came, thinning hair dragged back into a tight bun, knobby hands folded in aproned laps, soft list slippers slit to ease the painful bunions. Apologetic, silent, arthritically awkward, or dredging from one task to another, pathetically anxious to please a harried daughter-in-law. Relics, they called them, flotsam from an earlier culture, bleached, dry, juiceless, helpless. Women who had once been strong and beautiful and suffered from that memory. And there were the ones who still had a measure of strength but were trapped in that dreadful bind that women were trapped in so little time ago. Not enough education to teach. Too old to be a clerk or a waitress. There was little other opportunity. Poverty was a sandpit, and they could not scale the walls. They fought, sometimes gallantly, sometimes bitterly, but mostly they lost. Their lives subsided into an empty, endless waiting. Even when their families cared for them and kept them safe, they still lacked their independence. For as much as your people care for you and you for them, absolute financial dependence is a terrible, crippling thing. Social Security helped to change that. It gave the elderly a measure of dignity. Not to have to ask for little things, silly little things that made you remember you were still a woman. To be able to buy a lipstick, to ease your drying skin with a pot of cream, and a small but solid contribution to the monthly bills, enough so that you could have a room of your own, with luck, a place of your own. Here, in my mountains, I am remarkably fortunate. Living is cheap. I have 7 acres of room. Room for dignity and freedom. Privacy to cry when I am sad and to dance when I am gay. It all comes in that little brown paper wrapper. And it lets me spit in anybody's eye.
Rosalie Sorrell's from her mother's work, Letters from Grimes Creek. A lot of the things that I have in my mind, a lot of the things that I am able to collect, and I'm an inveterate collector. You don't know, but years ago I used to be an archivist for the state of Utah, and I think that one of the qualifications for archivist is being a pack rat. I collect things, and there are people out there who help me do it, like Lou Curtis and Rare Records down in San Diego, and of course Glenn Howard, who has provided me with a number of the things that I've been privileged to share with you. I want to Most of what he sent me has been musical, but he sent me one spoken piece from years and years ago by Les Pine. Let's listen to Depression.
It's a complicated society we live in. You know, nothing is what it appears to be. Like, I'll look at a thing. With my bold eyes, I see it is what it is. But obviously, if it looks like what it is to me, couldn't be. I ain't got a pot. My finances are shot. And to me, conditions don't look so hot. In fact, a depression, that's what we got. But if I say depression, and no, it's not. I'm broke, unemployed, I owe money, I can't pay. So I'm gonna go listen to what I say. Dictionary says depression, that which is depressed. Flattened from above. I don't know, I looked in the papers the other day to see what the financial experts say, and according to the papers, Financial Whiz, it ain't a depression. You know what it is? A reverse upward trend. Something's wrong, but it won't last long. Either it's a very busy slack season or a very slack busy season. I'm a schnooker. What do I know from depressions, recessions, the status quo? If it ain't a depression, the discussion is done. So it ain't a depression. So it feels like one. And listen, I don't want to be pessimistic because I remember what happened in 1929. 29er stocks are dropping, banks are flopping, factories stopping, the wolf is squatting at everyone's door, guys are jumping from the 25th floor. What happened? People lost confidence. And that's what caused the depression. Now, I'm not pessimistic. I just want to know, what is the status of the status quo? If we got a depression, I'll starve with a smile. Because in a depression, that's the style. But if it ain't a depression and everything's sweet, I'd like to get my furniture off the street. I read the financial page. The Federal Reserve Board Index shows a very marked decline in the average for the month of May of 1949, which indicates a drop in the rate of the all-time high of 48, which is 2 points higher and 3 points slower than 199.04442. Net! Which is a very clear picture of the financial scenes. You tell me what the hell that means? 1948, I lost my job. 1950, get another one. The very next day, I get my pay, and pinned with a clip is a little pink slip containing a note, and the note says, quote, "Dear employee, you must understand the law of the land is supply and demand. P.S., you can." So I got no money, no 5220. I fight with my wife. It's a hell of a life. I lost my flat. I ate the cat. So what does the president say about that? The economy's sound. The country's wealthy. It's a passing phase. It's normal. It's healthy. All right. If it's healthy, I got no kick. But God forbid it should ever get sick. So I go to see this feller, a fortune teller. I says, "Tell me, oh Swami, wise and just, what have we got, the boom or a bust? Come and gaze in your crystal ball and speak, oh wise man, tell me all." He says, "Boom or bust, how can I say? They came and took my ball away."
Well, that was Les Pine. We weren't able to get through all of that because needed to forge ahead here as we draw close to the finish line. I worked for a downtown organizing committee some years ago to get old funds from Washington they were giving away to help neighborhoods, but they'd forgotten to define the downtown, the skids, as a neighborhood. So we had a downtown neighborhood organizing committee to at least get some block watch and and a community center. They asked me to speak when we finally got the neighborhood organized, and I didn't. I said I would rather do them the poem, and this is the poem I made. It's called What We Need. Everyone needs a nice place to live in and good food to eat that's not too expensive, and clean clothes with no holes or patches, a doctor to call, an old friend to visit, a way to get places, parties, and music, a street to walk safely, and benches to sit on with shade in the summer, and warm, friendly places to be in the winter. Some work to do that's useful to others and doesn't get boring. People to come to for all kinds of answers, and somebody checking so no one's forgotten. Money to spend that's given and taken without feeling guilty. Love without pity. Pride without anger. Everyone knows what everyone needs, but programs, laws, city councils, commissions, agencies, bureaus can't give it to us. All of us need the best in each other, and if we can find it, and if we can give it, the rest will soon follow. If we all stick together, we'll get what we need. Thanks for setting your dial for Loafer's Glory, the Hobo Jungle, the Mind. You'll hear from me again. Now keep talking to each other. We're all looking for the village. And when we find it, we'll sit down together and tell each other our life stories, and we will be healed. I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree. In fact, unless the billboards fall, I'll never see a tree at all. Ogden Nash. Ha!